This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Under any scenario, we will need carbon removal to avoid the worst impacts of climate change.
Most of us aren't aware of just how much carbon dioxide is emitted from biomass wastes such as sawdust, forest thinnings, and agricultural residuals. But woody biomass energy production emits roughly double the carbon pollution per unit of electricity of coal and 4.5 times that of gas. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Hannah Murnin, the chief technology officer at a carbon dioxide removal startup known as Graphite, to learn more about the company and the industry as a whole. We discuss how their technology is able to safely store biomass waste that would otherwise decompose or be burned, and get a better understanding of how carbon offsets work. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Hannah Murnin. She is the CTO, the Chief Technology Officer of Graphite. Hannah, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
So Graphite is a startup company in the carbon removal space. Maybe you can start off by explaining what that means and give us a glimpse of your technology if you can.
Yeah, sure. So as many folks are probably aware, the concentration of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere has been going up, which has been contributing to climate change over time. And while a big part of improving that situation is to reduce the amount of carbon that we're emitting by changing the way that we create electricity and the cars we drive and all of those types of activities, it's also pretty clear that it's necessary to actually remove carbon from the atmosphere, carbon removal. And that can be done in a variety of ways, including everything from literally sucking it directly out of the air with big fans and various absorbing materials, or we can rely on plants that have been doing that for centuries. So the way that Graphite's technology works is that we take biomass, plant matter, that has captured carbon dioxide out of the air through photosynthesis, and we prevent that carbon from getting back into the atmosphere. So normally, waste biomass, think agricultural residuals, leftovers from sawmills, timber processes, things like that. Usually that biomass decomposes or sometimes is burned, but in either case, the carbon that's enclosed in that biomass is returned back into the atmosphere. And so what Graphite does, our process takes that biomass, dries it down below a level at which decomposition can occur. So if you dry it sufficiently, microbes cannot live, and therefore they can't be doing the decomposition process. So we dry it down sufficiently, then we densify it, we create little blocks of it, and we encapsulate and store those so that water cannot get back in for centuries, thousands of years. And the purpose of all of that is to prevent that carbon from ever returning into the atmosphere. So once we create that inert carbon, we store it and do that in a way that restores land that has been denigrated over time. So essentially we work with generally surface mines where we've been excavating and taking things out of the land, think gravel, think aggregate, think rocks. Now you have a big hole in the ground, we're filling that back up with inert carbon and returning that land into use. So we're both taking carbon out of the air, restoring it back into the ground and bringing that land back into useful purposes.
If you can give us an example of Graphite's carbon removal process in action, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. So we have our operating project in central Arkansas. We're about 30 miles south of Little Rock, Arkansas. And in our processing plant, which is in a town called Pine Bluff, we're bringing in rice hulls. So in Arkansas, there's a lot of rice processing. And at the back end of a rice processing plant, you know, at the front end, the farmer's dropping off rice. At the back end of the rice processing plant, you have a lot of these hulls. They're basically the outside of the rice grain that can't be eaten. Those hulls are a waste product with very little use on the back end. And basically, they sit around in giant piles and decompose. We're bringing those hulls into our process. They're very, very dry already. We're densifying them, encapsulating them. And then we drive them to our storage site, which is an old gravel mine. So it was a giant excavated hole in the ground in a town called Sheridan, Arkansas, which is about 20, 30 miles away from our processing site. And we're placing that dried, densified, encapsulated biomass into the ground, into storage chambers, sort of like tombs. Those tombs are designed to keep water out. So all of the engineering, all of the materials of construction, et cetera, are designed to prevent water from ever accessing that biomass again. And so we're filling that land in, turning it back into a park for the public. And so that's exactly how the sort of the in real action, how it's working. We're taking, starting from those, that byproduct of the agricultural process, all the way through to entombing that biomass underground and preventing the carbon from getting out.
And I saw that American Airlines has a deal with graphite. Are they buying carbon offsets, or do they have waste product themselves that graphite is processing?
They are purchasing credits. Yep. So most of our customers are directly purchasing credits, which means that our process is validated by a third party, and the credits are on what's called a registry, in this case, a company called Isometric. That registry validates that we're doing what we're saying we're doing, that we're keeping track of all of our carbon accounting. And then we sell the associated carbon credits, which are purchased by companies like American Airlines, who have made, you know, targets for themselves, have committed to reduce their emissions over time, whether they're net zero targets or reductions in their emissions over time. Much of that is met through reduction in emissions directly, meaning, you know, they're switching the types of fuels that they're working on, they're, you know, designing airplanes to be more efficient, et cetera. Or if there's some that is very, very hard to abate or hard to reduce, that's where carbon credits can come in. And so companies like American Airlines, Boston Consulting Group, those types of company are purchasing credits from us to meet those commitments that they've made around their reduction in emissions.
You mentioned these rice hulls, but give us a spectrum of the palette that you can work with now and what you hope to work with in terms of the materials that you can sequester.
Yeah, one of the really nice things about our process is that it's very simple, and we're not doing any sort of chemical change to the biomass or the materials within it. So that means that we are what we like to say biomass agnostic, meaning we can work with a lot of different types of biomass. So for example, I referenced the rice hulls for our project in Arkansas. We have a second project that's up and coming in Arizona. In that project, the feedstock is going to be wildfire thinnings from forests surrounding the area where our project will be. So that project's located in northern Arizona near Flagstaff. There's a number of national forests in that surrounding area where over time, because of fire suppression, the density of trees has dramatically increased and has created a very sort of unsafe, unsustainable situation where you now have lots and lots and lots of low diameter trees that are just ripe for wildfire. And so the Nature Conservancy, who we're partnering with, along with the US Forest Service, is going in and doing thinning of those forests to try and return them to a more natural state with fewer trees per acre, but larger diameter trees. But the biomass that they pull out as part of that process is very difficult to do anything with. It's low diameter trees, it's not merchantable. Generally, what happens to it is it gets pile burned. They literally pile it up and burn it, light it on fire, which nobody likes because it, besides putting the carbon right back into the air, it also has the impact of particulate emission. It's creating a bunch of soot and ash in the air around the area. So that project for us will take that feedstock, that biomass feedstock, which is a woody waste, it's ponderosa, pine mostly, and bring that into our process and do the same thing, dry, densify, encapsulate, and store underground. So that's a very different feedstock than the rice hulls that we're using in Arkansas. You can also imagine eventually getting to a place where you might use purpose-grown crops, where you're growing material specifically for the purpose of collecting carbon out of the air and storing it underground. So because, again, we're not doing any sort of chemical transformation, we're very, very flexible on what that feedstock looks like.
How mobile is your process? I know that you bake these things into these brick-like substances before you seal them. At this juncture, you're still a startup. How flexible is it in terms of location?
Yeah, so we're quite flexible in terms of location. We're actually looking at a number of international expansion, including in Southeast Asia and Brazil, areas you can imagine where there's a lot of biomass. To date, our facilities, both in Arkansas and soon to be Arizona, have been stable, meaning like we're taking our processing site as a building, and that's where we have our equipment and we're processing there. We are in the process of designing a mobile processing unit, which would be much more where we could like pull up to a site, process a bunch of biomass, and then move on. There's trade-offs, as you can imagine, for access to energy, you know, whether you're connecting to the grid for electric energy for some of the processing or using diesel for running mobile equipment, things like that. So in some scenarios, it makes sense to be more mobile. In some scenarios, it makes sense to be stationary. The sort of size that we've been building all of our units to right now is 50,000 tons of carbon removed per year. That's sort of the base size. We can scale it up from there. So if it's a place where there's, you know, 1 million tons of biomass availability per year and we have demand for the credits, we can scale that facility up. But that's sort of the base size that we've been designing to, which is a nice size in that You can be very profitable at that size, and you're not having to draw biomass from a very large radius. So some of the larger facilities, like some of the BECCS facilities that you may have heard about that are running a million tons a year, they have to pull from a really wide radius of biomass, meaning you're driving and transporting biomass a long distance, which can obviously have emissions implications, but also implications on the ecosystems you're operating in.
Are my babies coming home tomorrow? Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news? Babies coming home tomorrow. Ain't that news? Man, ain't that news? I got a letter just the other day telling me that she was on her way and she wanted me to meet her at the station. Ain't that good news?
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Hannah Mernon. She's the Chief Technology Officer of Graphite. And graphite is spelled Graphyte. So, Hannah, you were talking about the emissions involved with this carbon removal process. Maybe you could speak further to what you and your team are doing to minimize those.
Yeah. First, it's worth saying that all of the emissions that we contribute to in our process are subtracted from anything we store underground. So any removal credits that we sell are the net removal from the entire process. So that includes any sort of transportation we're doing, any sort of drying, any of the electricity to have our facility open, all of that, any emissions associated with that are subtracted off of our credits that we're producing.
And how significant a portion of that is in your calculations?
So that's one of the very nice things about our process is it's very energy efficient. So for every ton of carbon that we remove, meaning that gets stored underground, 89%, somewhere between 88 and 90%, ends up as a true net removal. So about 10% of the emissions, about 10% of that carbon we're emitting in the process of doing the, you know, processing and storing. And that's just with grid electricity and sort of traditional methods. We have only improvement to make from there as we start implementing things like more renewable energy sources and things like that. That's in contrast to some other methods like direct air capture, for example, is hugely energy intensive and relies on, you have to have renewable energy to run those sorts of projects because they're so energy intensive to do the capture of the carbon. In our case, we're quite efficient. The main energy uses are transportation, so moving things around, drying the biomass, and then producing some of the materials we work with, some of the materials of construction and things like that.
So Hannah, maybe you can address the larger issue that you mentioned in the outset and what your industry as a whole needs to do to help us achieve a net zero economy.
There are a lot of scientists who have looked at this issue and tried to assess how much carbon removal will we actually need to, you know, maintain global warming below a degree and a half. And there's some variation in the numbers that they report, but take the IPCC, for example. They cite that we're going to need 13 gigatons of removal of carbon dioxide by 2050. That is a lot, and we are nowhere near that right now.
And 2050 is not that far from now.
And 2050 is not that far away. It sounds far away, but it's really not that far away. So just to give context, you know, recently, I think it was last year, the technological removal of CO2 was around 0.0013 gigatons. So a very small fraction of what the IPCC is saying that we're going to need by 2050. And, you know, frankly, we're not scaling fast enough. And part of that is demand, you know, enough. Right now, it's mainly the voluntary market where you're relying on companies who are making voluntary commitments around their emissions. There are compliance markets in various jurisdictions that are coming into shape and are going to take a big piece of this. But a lot more is going to be needed in order for us to reach those targets or get anywhere near those targets to reduce some of the greatest impacts of global climate change.
So what could governments do? What can the corporate world do in concert with technologies like yours to really supercharge this process?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question and an interesting time. Really, we're at the beginning of developing a true market. At the end of the day, we are trying all collectively to develop a market for carbon removal where there's a clear set of standards about what a ton removed looks like, what sort of durability are we talking about, how are we monitoring it, and a clear sort of financial market for incentivizing those activities. A big part of what needs to happen is longer term commitments, meaning for a supplier like graphite, we have to build a facility or invest in a facility, same with many of the other technologies. So we have to have capital to build that facility. However, to get that capital, we need to show that there's demand for the credits coming out of that facility. And if we only have, people who want to buy spot credits in 2026 and 2027, it's very hard to invest the money to build the facility that's going to be a 20-year facility removing carbon over that time.
Are spot credits like that American Airlines offset purchase that you were mentioning earlier?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I think American Airlines purchased in the short term. We have other deals that are longer term that are 5-year commitment deals, meaning, customers are saying we want to buy X amount in each ensuing year. Really, what we need are like 10 and 15 and 20-year offtake agreements. Think more like utility agreements where, somebody's committing to purchasing out of a facility for a very long period of time. That certainty, knowing that somebody is willing to purchase and they've said what price they're willing to purchase it at, unlocks financing. Because now you can say to a finance partner, look, I have 80% of the offtake of this facility already spoken for at this price. Here's how it works out from an economics perspective. Here's the return on your investment you're going to get. And that's what this market really needs, is to move towards those longer term offtake agreements and to unlock that financing. Right now, it's very sort of nascent. You have a lot of these smaller purchases, shorter duration, smaller amount of credits. That makes it very difficult for suppliers to build the size facilities that will scale and for the financiers to sort of come in and support those facilities at scale. So everybody's kind of edging towards that. We're starting to get there, and I'm excited about some of the things that Graphite specifically is doing around that. But in general, I think that's one of the things that is really needed. That can come either through companies, making larger purchases. And Microsoft, of course, is the biggest purchaser who has really committed to a lot of these long-term deals. We need more Microsofts, as well as compliance market activities. So Canada is doing a lot of things to try and incentivize and to lay the groundwork for requiring some of these types of activities. There's some movement in Europe, in Japan, and other places like that where compliance markets could also step in. But a lot of it's in flux, and a lot of things have to happen right for it to all shake out the way we want.
So, are there any governments that are mandating carbon removal? And if the United States government were to put in something or a state would mandate something, what would that look like? Do we have templates to work from, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, there are definitely some governments that are putting compliance frameworks into place. And what I mean by compliance frameworks is instead of it being voluntary, where companies are choosing to set targets for themselves and choosing to, publicly announce those and then to work towards meeting those commitments, compliance markets means that under law, you have to do the reduction or the carbon removal activity. And there are governments that are working on that. The EU has some nascent frameworks in place, Japan and Canada is the other one. Canada is one that we've spent the most time with because we're looking at a project in British Columbia. And in that scenario, different industries have different mandated reductions that the government has set. And there's a portion of that that can be met with carbon removal. So they have to take abatement activities, meaning they need to reduce the amount that they're emitting, but they're also able to purchase removal credits under those compliance frameworks. Those types of activities are very open up the market a lot for a supplier like Graphite because they set a price for those credits, meaning the compliance markets have a price built in and say, credits can be have to be as much as X dollars per ton. That locks in certainty back to this financing point around how do we build these facilities. If we can lock in price and show that there's demand through a compliance framework, there's a lot of certainty in that for a company like Graphite, which enables us to then build and scale these projects. So there are frameworks in place, and if the US eventually starts to move in that direction, I think a lot will have been learned from some of these early activities. And you can imagine different states taking different tactics around this. Of course, California being one that has often been out ahead of a lot of these emissions and sort of climate challenges. If CARB, for example, wanted to put in some of these frameworks, there's a lot that has already been learned from some of these other governmental efforts.
If you can give us a snapshot of the company's financials right now, where you are as a startup and who's invested, that would be terrific. And in terms of your size, like headcount, et cetera.
Yeah, sure. So we're a relatively early company. We were founded about 3 years ago in 2023. We have raised up through a Series A in venture capital. So what that means is, we've done a seed round And then a Series A round, we've raised about $44 million, $43.5 million, something like that in venture capital. We have some great investors on that venture capital pool. We have Prelude Capital, Carbon Direct Capital, and Breakthrough Energy Ventures. So some of the top investors in climate and hard tech are some of the ones we work with. We have also worked on raising project capital. And so I can't share any of the names of that just yet. We're in the process of finalizing some very exciting activities there, but we're working towards being able to finance directly at the project level instead of at the venture capital level. The purpose of that, of course, is to lower the cost of the capital and reduce the sort of friction to being able to build projects. From a size perspective, we're still quite small. We have an operating facility in Arkansas that's running 24/7. So we have 20 to 25 employees in Arkansas who are working at our facility. And then at our corporate level, meaning just everybody else who's trying to get the projects built and trying to expand, we're about 15 people. So still a pretty early venture, working very hard to scale. We have a couple job openings open, so look at our website.
There's much for you to do. Only asking you what you're needing. The rest is up to you. Plant your love and let it grow.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Hannah Mernon. She is the CTO of Graphite. So, Hannah, what's the competitive landscape of your industry look like? I assume your technology is one that you own, but we can't just hope one company comes up with a great patent and then voila, no more greenhouse gas emissions. How do you foresee the carbon removal space in general being able to scale from a technology standpoint?
There are a number of really interesting technologies that folks are working to develop. And I think you're right. We can't rely on one sort of silver bullet across this issue. There's several buckets of technologies, I would say. So you have direct air capture, which is literally taking CO2 directly out of the air. And that has, I think, seen a lot of promise, and folks get very excited about it, particularly as you could scale over time and bring down the costs. But it is very energy intensive and right now very expensive. So you're talking like thousands of dollars per ton of CO2. Another bucket is what's called enhanced rock weathering, which is basically trying to work with rock that can absorb CO2 more quickly. And so you can process the rock into smaller pieces, spread it out, try and capture CO2 more quickly. That has a lot of benefits because it's often working in concert with farmers and with agriculture to help soil improvement and things like that. So that's another type of technology that people are working to scale. It has challenges around measuring exactly how much carbon dioxide you've removed through the process, and also monitoring. How do you know where it stays? Is it staying in the soil and the rocks? How do you sort of think about that whole measurement side of it? The biomass-based solutions, of which graphite is one, have seen a lot of growth over the last, call it 18 to 24 months. And if you look at some of the sort of leading registries like Isometric, who we work with, the greatest number of credits are through biomass related solutions. And so what graphite is doing, direct storage, is a big growing area. There's a couple other suppliers who are working in that area. Biochar is another area that has gotten a lot of interest, where in that case, you're taking biomass and pyrolysizing it into a more stable form of carbon to, store that carbon over time. That has a lot of promise. One of the challenges there is that you actually end up, if you have 1 ton of carbon in biomass through the pyrolysis process, you may lose as much as, 40 to 60% of that carbon in the process. And so that can be very difficult from what's called a carbon efficiency standpoint, as far as like how much of that carbon are you actually storing. So I quoted for graphite, we're sitting in that like 88 to 90% carbon efficient. That's very different than a biochar solution where you're chemically pyrolysizing the carbon to try and lock it into the more stable form. So all that to say, there's a lot of different efforts here, and I'm a firm believer and we need sort of many shots on goal. I think the biomass-based solutions have been shown to be the most scalable right now and to be able to be the sort of lowest hanging fruit for us as a society to advance at this time. And so you're seeing a lot of purchases and a lot of growth in credit supply coming from the biomass-based solutions.
And do all of these carbon removal systems that you just outlined for us, do they rely as in terms of their business models on carbon offsets as well, or do they differ?
Good question. Most of them, and I didn't even get into nature-based solutions like forest restoration or things like that, which is another sort of category. They're sort of nature-based solutions, engineered solutions. Most of what I just talked about are engineered solutions, but you also have, forest restoration or mangrove restoration or things like that, where you're using natural systems to store carbon over time. So whether they're engineered or nature-based solutions, all of these carbon removal mechanisms do rely on selling credits at the end of the day. The sort of main economic driver for these, there's no economic reason to put carbon in the ground other than for meeting emissions target.
So to a layman who has just heard about this offset idea for the first time, explain how it's not a Sisyphean task, how we're not just collectively chasing our own tails here. Like an American Airlines can buy some offsets through you guys, but they're still flying their jets all around the world. How is that reducing American Airlines' carbon emissions?
Yeah, so for sure, and the IPCC is very clear about this, just as one sort of governing scientific body, but we should collectively be doing abatement or reduction in emissions. And what that means is American Airlines should be looking at different fuel types, whether it's sustainable aviation fuel or, changing the routes that they fly to make them more, reduce the emissions. Similarly, power plants should be looking at how to shift fuel mixes or to implement more renewable energy sources, things like that. All of those things need to happen so that the amount that we're putting into the air goes down. But at the same time, we also need carbon removal to be removing the sort of store of CO2 that we've built up in the atmosphere. You can think about it like a bathtub. We need to turn off the faucet and stop filling up the bathtub, but we also need to have a drain that's draining out what we've already built up in the bathtub. And so there are lots of climate modelers who look at the different rates of both of those things, both the filling up of the bathtub and the draining of the bathtub. And it's pretty clear that under any scenario, we will need carbon removal to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. We should also be running at reducing the filling up of the bathtub as much as we possibly can.
She's the CTO, the Chief Technology Officer of Graphite, Hannah Mernon. Hannah, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
Come what may, down crooked paths once more. Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Christian McBride, Sam Cook, and Eric Clapton.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.